I still love the business model, only now I get to meet the women. And I get to see these women who, maybe on the first day of their employment with us, they come across as feeling angry or defensive. And then in a pretty short amount of time, they literally transform. And I think they become the women they were meant to be.
Welcome to ProCo 360. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. This show, like many, features successful entrepreneurs, but unlike the others, all our guests, like you and I, choose Colorado. Success looks different here. It's multidimensional. That's why I promote the phrase, live, work, love Colorado. Today's show is special. I'm speaking with Tamara Ryan of the Women's Bean Project. This is a nonprofit entrepreneurial venture that I love because it breaks the cycle of poverty by teaching job skills and entrepreneurial thinking to women. Tamara is a veteran marketer from the private sector who's now leading a nationally recognized organization. She's a speaker and an author, and I'm confident you'll be fascinated and moved by this conversation. Tamara, thanks for joining me.
It's great to be here.
Thanks to sponsors Community Banks of Colorado and MicroStar Keg Logistics. I appreciate their support for Colorado entrepreneurs and for this show. Let's get started. Tamara, I gave a quick overview of the Women's Bean Project. I'm sure you can do much better than I, so jump right in, please.
Well, we're a food manufacturer. We make a line of dry food mixes. I think that's not what's special about us, though. It's that we hire women who are chronically unemployed, and we teach them to work by making these products. They work for us for 6 to 9 months, and at the end, they move on to mainstream employment in the community. Mm. So we exist to make these products to pay for the business, and yet we really exist to teach women who are chronically unemployed to work.
Yeah, and you're an author, too. And in your book, The Third Law, you say, despite what I originally thought, the Bean Project is not a particularly good business model. There's a constant tension between the business and the mission. And why do you say that? What's that mean?
Well, first of all, that's what I love about it, because every day is trying to find a balance between those two things. What I often say is we don't exist to make bean soup, but yet we can't exist without it. So we hire women who no one else will hire, who are chronically unemployed. A typical woman we hire hasn't had a job longer than a year in her lifetime, though the average age is 38.
Wow.
So we're taking these women onto our payroll. They're helping us make these great products. They work for us for 6 to 9 months. And during that time, our entire goal is to make them great employees so they can leave, which is really kind of a dumb way to
And I can see where that tension comes in. In fact, you mentioned that you make bean soup. And one of the great stories in your book is about this 10 bean soup. Can you share that, please?
Well, 10 bean soup was our original product. 29 years ago, we started with a $500 investment in beans, and we put two women to work. And that's the genesis of Women's Bean Project. When I started in 2003, we had a production line going, and 9 bean soup was being made. And so for a whole afternoon, the women on the production line hadn't noticed that the 10th bean wasn't out. And so it was really literally a day that was lost because, you know, if you say on your packaging it's 10 bean soup, it turns out it has to be 10 beans.
Although no one would have counted, right?
Well, probably not. But there are regulations around food manufacturing. Yep. And I think that's the other thing that makes this a bit of a challenge is we're a very regulated industry. Mm. And it's become more so during our history. And so we're having to teach, you know, basics of food production and food safety and things like that. And we need the women to get up to speed really quickly.
But this is really about values, wasn't it? About values as a business and values of how an employee ought to think about delivering what's promised.
Well, I think all of those things are also true. It's also about helping people who don't have a work history and probably to the extent that they've had jobs have not had a job where they're a part of the whole, where they're valued by the employer. And so they come in and we want them to have ownership in those products. So one of the signature aspects of our product line is that every one of our products is sealed with a sticker that says lovingly handmade by, and it's signed by a woman in the program. We want her to feel that ownership because this work is really a part of her future. It's about creating a new life for herself.
So what's the end of that story? Because you going back to that tension between a business and a mission, right? You ended up with a whole day's production of 9 bean soup. So what's the end of that story?
Well, you know, that's product that we had to sell sort of off, you know, off the shelf for to customers who were willing to take it. But it wasn't product that we could distribute through the grocery and things like that. And we had to have the opportunity to talk with the women yeah. about the fact that we can't sell 9-bean soup as 10-bean soup. And you know, lots of things like that happen along the way, again, because we're always in training mode. So we hire about every 8 weeks. So we have a new group starting.
You're never, I mean, most businesses just can't wait for the day when people are trained and they can just produce right. and become more and more efficient. You never dream to be more efficient, do you?
Yes and no. I mean, I think we need a certain amount of efficiency, but the onus is on us to be great at training. Mm-hmm. So we need to get the women up to speed as quickly as possible and have great training in so that we can be as efficient as possible. The great thing in a way about always hiring new women is that those who have tenure with us can step up to leadership roles.
Yeah.
And so I think what happens a lot of times is women discover leadership that they didn't even know they had.
That's so interesting to me in today's world where workers are in such high demand and such a short supply, most employers don't want to hire people that require a lot of training. And you've figured out, well, that's just what you do. That's what you have to do, right?
It's what we do. And also what we find is that the skills we're teaching are what every employer needs and what these entry-level workers are lacking. So we're focused on, yes, we produce our products, but we're focused on attendance and punctuality and paying attention to detail and communication skills and conflict resolution.
Well, it's funny, too. In your book, you say, most businesses try to hire the best workers. Women's Bean Project hires the worst. I mean, that sounds like it's kind of the crux of it.
It absolutely is. It's helping someone who I think really has never believed that she's worthy of something better. She doesn't believe she's worthy of being hired by somebody who's going to care that she comes to work every day or is going to be invested in her that she to have a future.
Yeah. What comes to mind as I was thinking about this, I recently watched a movie called The Soloist. I don't know if you've seen it. It's Jamie Foxx and Robert Downey Jr. and does an amazing job portraying this talented musician. He drops out of Juilliard because of mental illness. And despite all efforts, it seems that he's never going to be able to operate, function in mainstream business as a job. I mean, when you look at candidates for the Women's Bean Project, how do you evaluate those who have the ability you feel to be trained to become successful and those who won't?
Well, first of all, we function with the basic belief that everyone has the ability to work. And so what that looks like for different people is different. But and so every woman we hire, we believe, has the ability to work if we can help her overcome her barriers to employment. So I think that that's sort of the first level is that. Also, we're looking for readiness for change. So, you know, we know when we're interviewing someone that she's not going to have a great work history, often has a pretty low education level. We do adult literacy and numeracy course, and we test the women on their reading level at the beginning. They have between a third and a seventh grade reading level. So we're intentionally hiring these women. None of those things are really important. What's important is whether or not she wants to have a new life.
How do you know? I mean, doesn't everyone say, well, maybe they don't?
Sometimes it's really profound things. Like, I remember a woman saying, I used to say I didn't want my kids to grow up to be like me. And then I realized that instead of not wanting them to be like me, I need to be someone my kids can be proud of.
Wow.
So that's a message that she wants to have a different life.
That's pretty interesting. I'm going to remind our listeners, this is ProCo 360, and I'm your host, Dave Tabor. This is a show featuring entrepreneurs and business leaders who could be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. I'm speaking with Tamara Ryan of the Women's Bean Project. And along the lines of what you just said about how people change sort of their views, as I was thinking about this and the movie I mentioned, The Soloist, and getting a bit personal, I mean, sometimes I wonder, like, really, how different am I from the people that you're seeing? And your focus is on breaking terrible cycles. Like, I've got bad habits. I've done bad, made bad decisions. And I guess the only difference between me and others is that I've lived a life where, you know, those kinds of decisions don't change, don't put me in a bad, right? I mean, how different am I and those listening now?
Well, I think one of the most humbling things for me going to the Bean Project is sitting across the table from someone who's been labeled by our community as an addict or a felon or chronically unemployed, and realize that except for the accident of birth, we're really not that different. Mm-hmm. I happened to be born to a white middle-class family with an expectation I would go to college. But what if I had been born instead to a family where my dad wasn't around and my mom was an addict, or we'd always been on welfare? I think that it's easy to judge someone for what their background is or the choices they've made. But one of the things I've realized is often when the women we serve have a set of, say, five choices, they're all bad choices. Mm-hmm. She's just choosing the best of the bad. Mm. And I think that's where sometimes we have a misunderstanding about the those who are chronically unemployed or those who have intergenerational poverty, that the choices aren't the same for all of us.
So as you have seen women change, is it because you're now presenting them with better choices from which they, I mean, would anybody change if they were faced with those kinds of better choices?
I think it's that they have gotten to a point where they see the manifestation of their choices. Mm. So the average woman we hire is, the average age is 38. So if you think about that in terms of, she's had a lot of years to make, to live the life that she's chosen. Mm-hmm. And so she's typically at a point where she's kind of out of options. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a little bit of human nature.
Yeah.
You know, when you're 20 and bulletproof, you're not really thinking about what you're doing today and how it's going to make, you know, what that's going to look like when you're 40.
Well, 38 surprises me. I had an expectation that it was mid 20s or something like that. Why do you think it's 38 and not something younger?
Well, I think it goes back to you're kind of bulletproof in your 20s. I mean, you're not really seeing that if I make this choice, this is where it's going to lead me.
Yeah.
So, and I think that then as they get closer to 40, they're really seeing that maybe their kids are starting to repeat the cycle.
Yeah,
or they've lost people in their lives. Or I really think that they're beginning to see the impact.
Yeah. You've also talked about like one of the chapters in your book, How I Learned to Step Beyond My Suburban Middle Class Roots. Is that something that you can't, that anybody can do, or is it something that you only can do when someone like you sort of says, okay, I'm giving up the private sector, I'm going to go do this?
I have to say, when I decided to make this change, I did it because I thought the business model was cool. Hmm. I didn't do it because I felt like I needed to change my opinions or my prejudices. I love this idea that we're as a business, and the better the business did, the more women could be served. The change that I experienced sort of happened along the way. Mm. One of the reasons I named the book The Third Law is because it's about how women work so hard to change their lives, and then there are forces that push back on that change. Mm. But it's also about how I went to this place that I thought was about other people changing, and I've changed in the process. This idea that it's not possible to witness transformation without being transformed. Mm. So it wasn't part of the master plan.
Yeah. Wow. So have you, this is really off script, but have you, based on that, do you have like different friends, different interests, different, has your whole life changed or is it different?
Well, I think certainly the things I care about are different. Mm. And my perspective, when I look at, for instance, when there's an initiative to be voted on, and I have a different perspective about how the women we serve are going to be affected.
Yeah. I mean, you place your graduates in the private sector. Right. How do you work with the employers when you do that?
What we find is we often have to find local companies, smaller companies, where we're actually talking with a leader in the company, and that person will be willing to give one of our graduates a chance. The advantage of 29 years of history is that we have lots of graduates who are in the community who have had long-term jobs. A year after graduation, 93% of the women who have graduated still have jobs.
That's amazing. Have any of your graduates that you can think of risen to sort of high-profile, you know, sort of roles where they become spokespeople for you out in the community?
Well, often that happens because we follow up with the graduates and we pay them. And we check in with them every 6 months, and we pay them to check in with us.
Oh, you do? Yeah. How cool is yeah. Because,
you know, I would check in for $50, right?
Cool.
And
yeah, yeah.
So we're able to talk with graduates who are out in the community, who are advancing in the businesses where they started. And 29 years, we have graduates for, you know, 15 plus years who we're still in touch with. In terms of advancement, you know, to the extent that they've started typically at an entry level position and they've moved up, definitely that's the case. They've become managers and supervisors and things like that.
Do employers have different expectations of them, and do they sign on to different expectations when they bring one of your graduates?
Maybe a little bit. I think that what they do is they're looking at it as giving someone a second chance. And then ultimately, it still is about coming to work every day and being reliable and all those things. But I think they're more willing to work with them. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they are, because we've taught the women how to communicate.
Yeah.
There's a real difference in terms of a supervisor working with you if you go in and say, hey, I'm having a problem with my childcare versus just coming to work late every day and, you know, or not showing up.
And are you getting feedback? I'm sure you do, from the employers where you've had successful placements. What are they learning from your grads too?
I think there is some learning. I think the best testament when we have a successful placement is that they call us and ask for another graduate. You know, if you have somebody else, we'd love to fill a position.
Is that happening often?
It happens fairly often. I mean, these are often pretty small companies,
so
they don't necessarily have a ton of positions.
Yeah.
But it's not unusual for us to hear from an employer that says, hey, we'd love to hire another one of your graduates.
That's awesome.
That's about matching people, because we want every woman to find her career entry-level job, and that's not going to be the same for every person.
So I didn't even know how to ask you this question, because as I was thinking about it, it's like, well, you guys are doing such great work. How come, you know, you're not huge? How come you're not in every city? How come, right? I mean, where's that?
Well, we're in about 1,000 stores across the country. So we're larger than most people realize.
For
our
sure.
price point's relatively low, which is, you know, is part of the reflection of the revenue. We're about $1.2 million in sales.
Which is not a tiny enterprise.
No, it's grown significantly in the time I've been there. As we've expanded our geographic distribution, so our grocery sales doubled this past year.
Wow!
We've changed all our packaging to do better on store shelves.
I'm looking at it; it's very pretty.
Thank you.
It's really nice. But as you said, the product is only half what you sell. The other half is the women that you... So why aren't other cities sort of saying, we want a Women's Bean Project?
Oh, they are.
Oh, they are.
Yes, I probably get a call or an email once every other week.
So is that going to happen, do you think? Or is this the kind of thing that needs to be grounded in one location?
I don't know that it necessarily needs to be grounded in one location. But when somebody calls us and says, hey, can you bring Women's Bean Project here? Mm-hmm. They're not saying, will you come and teach us how to make bean soup? They're really, I think what's intriguing to them is the fact that we've incorporated this life change program with the business.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've chosen instead is I've gotten really involved in the social enterprise movement across the country. I'm the board chair for Social Enterprise Alliance, which is our national association. And then I've been doing a lot of work with Social Enterprise World Forum, which is sort of the international group for social enterprise. And what we've chosen to do, rather than expand Women's Bean Project, is be more thought leaders and provide expertise to peers across the country.
Because it seems to me that the big challenge we have in our nation is to do more of what you're doing, is to break the cycle more.
Yeah.
And it's hard to scale. I know it's hard to scale. If we don't scale, though, we end up with more people sleeping on the street and all these other social, right? And I think most of us who admire what you do want to see it bigger.
Right. Because we were founded in 1989, we were formed as a 501c3, a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And I really think that's because in 1989, if you wanted to do good, regardless of how you were doing it, you had to be a nonprofit. Today, there are other options for legal structures.
Mm-hmm.
And because we are a 501c3, it's really created challenges in terms of scale. So, for instance, if we get an investment, it's, you know, the only option is debt. Because there's no such thing as equity.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, in a traditional way that we might grow a business if we were a for-profit, some of those avenues aren't available to us.
Do you wish maybe you were a benefit corporation or something else? Or
depends on the day you ask
me. I guess
me.
I'd probably,
so,
yeah.
You know, but on the flip side, though, we've gotten contributions, donations, and grants that we've used and we've asked for in order to invest in our business.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know that I think we've made the 501c3 work for us.
Yeah.
And I would say that because of how we choose to run our business, it's inherently, you know, limiting in terms of our growth.
It is hard, I think, inherently too, to scale something that's so hands-on.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, if you're doing this so well for how many women a year?
Last year, 71
women. So now it's like, well, if you just multiply times 100 or 10,000, look at the impact.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, you do that and then you end up with something like a government program that doesn't work.
Yeah. It's a balance. I think one of the things we're in the midst of doing is actually raising funds so we can automate. And, you know, so
that must be, if you're automating, you're not having as many women work.
Well, that's not our plan. So it's not going to be 100% automated, but certain aspects of our processes will be automated. And our goal will be that we move the women to other tasks.
Mm-hmm.
And really, we're doing it so that we can scale our operations.
Yeah. And not only that, actually, when I think about all the manufacturing companies and so forth, they're not shrinking their workforce. They're doing more with the same amount of people. And I suppose that kind of training makes your graduates even more marketable.
It's much more transferable.
Yep,
Nobody is going to hire one of our women to manually fill any bags.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I could see how you can scale. I am looking at, by the way, listeners, one more reminder that this is ProCo 360. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. I'm speaking with Tamara Ryan of the Women's Bean Project. Please go to ProCo360.com to subscribe to the newsletter, read my blog, and catch the books I'm listening to on Audible. And please, please, it really helps us if you rate the podcast in your app. So I'm looking at your brochure, which I get because I'll just tell the listeners, I'm a contributor. Cheryl and I contribute to the Women's Bean Project. And again, because we love the idea that you're breaking this cycle of poverty and you're helping to uplift people who then have lives, better lives forever.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for that great work.
Yeah, well, thank you.
I am looking at your catalog. And one of the things that I'll describe to listeners is that the title of this catalog is The Impact of Your Purchase, and that's the title of your catalog. So one of the things that crosses my mind is so many companies are, their whole sales and marketing model is for every X you buy, we donate Y to charity, blah, blah, blah. This is really a different, I think it's important to note, this is a different model. This is not a, we make our buyers feel better by purchasing. This is something different, right?
Well, I do hope buyers feel better about purchasing. And also,
it's different.
A buyer knows that there is an actual woman behind that product whose life is being changed. And it goes back to one of the things we do on every one of our products is, every one of our products has a little stamp. And so I'm looking
Tamara's pointing at it. Yeah, what does it say here?
Well, that is our 10-bean soup. And so it says, these beans create jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And then our biscuit mix says, these biscuits create jobs.
Mm.
And so that is one we want. If this gets into somebody's hands, we want them to know that there is a life that's being changed through a job.
Yeah.
Also, every one of our products is sealed by a sticker that says Lovingly Handmade By, and it's signed by a woman in our program.
This one's Jasmine.
And Natasha is this one. And I want, you know, our product ends up in a lot of people's hands who we've never interacted with.
Yeah.
You know, it's picked up at Meijer grocery store in the Midwest.
Mm.
And so we want that person who picks up that product to know that there's something more, that there's an impact of making this product.
And just to plug Women's Bean Project, please, your website is?
womensbeanproject.com.
Thank you. And I'm going to let my listeners know right now that all of my holiday gifts are coming from the catalog. And great. I just think it's so nice to share. First of all, I don't like buying people stuff that they have to find a place for. Consumable products are great, and yours help others. And I think it's a tremendous way to go.
Well, I appreciate that. And what we find is that when someone receives it as a gift, they often become customers themselves.
Oh, excellent. So you've been doing this for 15 years, and you described, I guess we talked a bit about why you switched from the private sector into Women's Bean Project, but talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I don't know that I knew what I was getting into. But I just loved the business model. My background's marketing. So there are many aspects of the Bean Project that are a marketer's dream come true.
Yeah.
You know, especially the fact that we have a product. So there's this surface on which we can tell our story.
With a great differentiator. You're right.
I mean,
that's the
exactly,
marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you thought you were taking this job as a businesswoman.
Yeah. Well, and fortunately, I think those were the skills that were needed at that time. I think what I didn't expect was that now that 15 years in, I still love the business model, only now I get to meet the women. Mm-hmm. And I get to see these women who maybe on the first day of their employment with us, they come across as feeling angry or defensive. Mm. And then in a pretty short amount of time, they literally transform. Mm. And I think they become the women they were meant to be.
Wow.
You know, the fact that they leave us and believe that they're worthy of a better life, that's probably the most significant transformation. I don't know how you measure that, yeah, but you sure know it when you see it.
Well, you've gained new perspectives. If you could imagine yourself going back into the private sector, what have you learned at Women's Bean Project that you think you could take and add value back?
I think a lot of it is about people want to feel some meaning to the things that they purchase. So to me, that would be the key differentiator is that this is about, you know, Women's Bean Project is about the fact that somebody's life is being affected through something pretty simple, a bean soup mix or cornbread mix or, you know, dog biscuits. Mm-hmm. You know, those things aren't inherently that sexy. But more and more customers, and the research shows this, that customers want to find meaning in their purchase. And so if I were to go back into the private sector, that's what I would be looking for, is to work with a product or a service that could do that.
That's so interesting, because I have a level of cynicism around companies that market to consumers to have a meaning in their purchase. Mm-hmm. And when I think of Women's Bean Project, it's so authentic in that.
Sure.
Drive, right?
Well, and it's true, and it has to be authentic. It can't be just, greenwashing or whitewashing.
Yeah, yeah.
It really does have, there has to be something to it. The conscious consumer research is showing that more and more people are interested in buying products with a mission behind it. But the reason they don't is because they don't know where to find it.
Really?
Yeah, that's more the thing that keeps them from doing it.
How much... Do you do research about how much people will pay? Do they pay? By the way, are your products competitively priced?
They are. They tend to be. They're competitive, but more on the gourmet side.
Right.
Our retail price for our soup mix is $5.95, but that serves 6 to 8 people.
Yeah.
So that's pretty
reasonable.
But I mean,
as you think about it as a marketing person, do you think about, like, what's the price differential you can charge for having an authentic mission that, you know, where people are saying, yeah, I'll pay X more because I know this is helping?
Well, the research again tells us that all other things being equal, which means quality and price and availability, then people will be willing to buy a product with a mission. So I really don't think there's a huge price premium place.
Mm-hmm.
No. And so we try to be competitive, and that might be competitive in a gourmet space.
Yes, yes.
And frankly, I think it's the mission that makes it gourmet versus the, you know, super fancy chocolate. You know, it's good quality ingredients.
Sure.
But that's, you know, what we're always trying to be cautious of.
That's an interesting statement. Mission makes it gourmet. Have you ever said that before?
No, I just made it up.
What do you think of it?
Well, I think that, you know, when you look at something gourmet, there's something about it that's special.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, what's special about our product is, well, first of all, they're great products.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have been able to be around for 29 years with just okay products, I think. We might have lasted 10 years.
Huh.
But so they're great products. They give you the ability to make something you feel like is homemade.
Mm-hmm.
and you look good to your family and your friends because you made this thing from scratch with a mix.
Do you think people talk about your products as they serve them to their families?
Yes. In fact, one of the things, as we're engaging, whether it's engaging someone as a volunteer first or as a customer or however we initially engage them, our goal is to then loop them in every other way. So I would love for you to buy our products as a gift. Mm-hmm. I'd also like you to serve them at home and maybe when you have company.
Mm-hmm.
And then
even better when I have company. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. And then you're going to maybe give them as a corporate gift. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you're going to volunteer for the Beam Project. Yeah. And maybe you'll also become a donor. And when we've engaged people at every possible level, then we've not only built community, but mm-hmm. we've also built really loyal
customers. Sure, yeah. That's cool. Hey, last question. That's the last one I'm anticipating. running a nonprofit's hard, mm-hmm. and you certainly don't do it for the money. So, where do you turn outside the organization for inspiration? I mean, I know internally that's clear. You're motivated mm-hmm. internally. Where do you turn outside for inspiration or strength when you need it and new ideas and things like that?
Well, we're at a really great time from a social enterprise standpoint. We're coming into our own. I often say it's like we've been wearing a velour tracksuit for 29 years and now velour tracksuits are cool.
Okay.
But, having people appreciate the work that we're doing is mm-hmm. really inspiring. And to the kind of support that we get.
But separate from the Beam Project, where do you get new ideas and where do you go?
Oh, I'm just always looking for innovation. So I love seeing sort of a fresh perspective or a new idea. And that can come a lot of different mm-hmm. ways. I mean, I read a ton.
Yeah.
And, I don't actually know where it comes from. I'm a runner, so that's how I sort of clear my head and get my new ideas. Mm-hmm. I have two kids who are 10 and 12, and sometimes just their perspective. And my daughter recently asked me, she was very upset about something, and she wanted to know how you pass a law, and because she wanted to change that. So it can come from anywhere. Yeah. I think it's just appreciating and maybe being open to it.
Well, cool. I'm going to wrap us up. Thank you, Tamara, for joining me today.
It was great to be here. Thanks, Dave.
I'm going to wrap up on ProCo 360. I'm Dave Tabor. You've been listening to my conversation with Tamara Ryan of the Women's Beam Project, a great nonprofit. Please check out their website, womensbeamproject.com. Thanks for joining me on ProCo 360, where we say live, work, love Colorado, because you and I and my guests can be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. You make the show successful by subscribing to the ProCo 360 podcast and by submitting a review. Thanks again to show sponsors, MicroStar Keg Logistics, Community Banks of Colorado, Jones and Keller, and the Colorado Chamber of Commerce, and to show engineer Mike here at Third and James Studios. That's the show. Live, work, love Colorado.